This is track 2 of lecture 6 of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
By the nature of the case, shortages lead sellers to regard customers not only as valueless, but as a positive nuisance, as a source of trouble and expense, not a source of livelihood. This occurs because, in fact, under a system of shortages and waiting lines, that is just what customers become. Under such a system, when a seller renders a customer some service or goes to some expense in his behalf, he is no longer doing it for the sake of gaining or keeping the customer's business and thereby earning his own livelihood. Because in fact, having the customer's business no longer depends on performing the service or incurring the expense. The seller can have the customer anyway, or if not that customer, then any one of 10 or 100 or 1,000 other customers. If the seller is to continue to provide the service or incur the expense for the sake of the customer, he can only do so out of a sense of altruistic duty, not out of the sense that in serving the customer, he serves himself. To say the same thing in slightly different words, price controls and the shortages they create take the profit out of serving the customer and the loss out of not serving him. They break the harmonious union of the self-interest of buyer and seller that prevails in a free market and replace it with an altruistic relationship between the two. In this relationship, the customer is reduced to impotent pleading for the customary service and the customary quality that the seller no longer has any economic motive to supply. Indeed, all of the seller's motives, both economic and non-economic, now work in the direction of reducing the quality of his product and the service associated with it. The seller's economic motive lies with reducing quality and service because by doing so, he reduces his costs and perhaps his own labor, and he does not have to fear any reduction in his revenues. For the same reason, employees feel free to work less hard in serving customers. Their poor performance no longer threatens their employer's revenue, and so he is no longer motivated to make them produce high-quality products and to treat customers properly. Observe, even under price controls, there is a tendency for customers to get what they pay for. To the extent that they pay prices below the potential free market prices, they tend to receive products that are below the level of the products they would have received in a free market. The fact that price controls inflict actual harm on the sellers, and the fact that this harm is inflicted for the avowed purpose of benefiting the buyers, introduces a non-economic element into the attitude of many sellers. They see themselves as being sacrificed for the benefit of their customers, and they may actually come to hate their customers as a result of it. In some cases, it is possible that they may derive actual pleasure from the reduction in quality and service that they impose on their customers. Price controls and shortages, in fact, launch a spiral of mutually reinforcing hatreds between buyer and seller. The buyer arbitrarily demands the quality and service he is accustomed to, even though he is not paying the necessary price any longer. The seller has no economic reason to comply with these demands, but on the contrary, has both economic and psychological reasons not to. The buyer then views the seller as an omnipotent tyrant whom he must beg for favors or threaten with reprisals in order to obtain what he wants. The seller views the buyer as an hysterical petty chiseler seeking values without payment. In degree that the accustomed quality and service are not forthcoming, the buyers become more shrill and insistent in their demands, and the sellers become correspondingly more resistant. These principles of deterioration of quality and service, accompanied by mutual hatred between buyer and seller, were illustrated to some extent in the gasoline shortage of early 1974. Suddenly, service station attendants, who had always cleaned windshields and eagerly volunteered to check under the hood, ceased to do so. Whereas before, they had always been courteous and polite, seeking to encourage as much repeat business as possible, suddenly they became surly and rude. The customer, who had always been king at the gas station, as everywhere else, suddenly became a useless pest waiting in line to have his tank filled and causing unnecessary labor to gas station attendants. The breakdown of the normal harmony of interests between buyer and seller and its replacement with open hostility was strikingly illustrated in the New York Times quotation of the day for February 5th, 1974. I will quote first the statement quoted by the Times, and then its description of the person and circumstances surrounding the quotation. I will omit the individual's name in order to spare him possible embarrassment. Quote, this is now the person being quoted. "If he's that stupid, he waits in line an hour and doesn't know the rules. I let him get to the pump, and then I break his heart." A service station attendant in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where gasoline rationing rules went into effect yesterday, unquote. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with the circumstances, what the attendant let the motorist wait in line an hour to find out was that he was there on the wrong day. His license plate ended with an odd number when it should have ended with an even number, or vice versa. Now, it might be argued that anyone who would behave in such a way must already have had serious problems. I am sure that is true. But it is no less true that the conditions created by price controls and shortages make it possible for such hostility to manifest itself. They encourage it and inflame it. The shortage of gasoline did not last long enough to make hatred between motorists and service station attendants become a regular feature of life. Today, normal relations have been restored, and the conditions of early 1974 have largely been forgotten. A more enduring, and therefore probably more significant example, is afforded by the relations between landlords and tenants in places like New York City, which has had almost continuous rent control since early in World War II. In New York City, mutual hatred between landlords and tenants is commonplace. It has become the norm. Nothing is more frequent than complaints about things landlords do not do, unless it is complaints about things they are trying not to do. For example, depending on the circumstances, landlords do not provide, or are trying to avoid providing, such services as doormen, painting, repairs, and even heat. Tenants regard all of these things as theirs by right, and hate the landlord for not supplying them, or trying not to supply them. Landlords, on the other hand, often regard the tenants as people who want to live without paying the proper rent. And in many cases, while they watch the real value of their investments shrink to zero, they observe tenants able to afford expensive automobiles and adopt the style of life that is above their own, made possible by the low, controlled rents they pay. In such circumstances, there are landlords who derive positive enjoyment from such things as providing no heat, as well as save money by it. Of course, I should also mention that there are many cases in which the controls make it impossible for a landlord to provide certain things, even if he wants to, for the sake of keeping up his building, such as a new boiler or wiring system, or any major repair or improvement. The controls often make these things impossible by leaving the landlord with too little capital to make the necessary investments. The hatred between landlords and tenants would disappear in a rental market that was free of controls. Such a market would restore economic power to the tenants. That is, tenants would regain the power to make landlords serve them out of self-interest. Consider how a free market would bring this about. The first effect of the establishment of a free rental market would be a jump in the previously controlled rents. This jump in rents would eliminate the shortage of rental housing. Immediately, even before any increase in the supply of rental housing could occur, the rise in rents would level the quantity of living space demanded down to equality with the limited supply that exists. In fact, the quantity of living space demanded would be reduced to a point somewhat below the supply that exists. Landlords would have some vacancies on their hands at free market rents. Precisely these vacancies is what would restore to tenants their economic power over landlords. At free market rents, each tenant would be able to choose from a large number of apartments available in his price range. If he did not like the service his present landlord gave him, he would simply move when his lease expired. He would not be in the position of having to regard his present apartment as the only one in the world and feel obliged to stay no matter how bad conditions in it became. By the same token, his landlord would no longer be able to count on easily replacing him. At free market rents, his landlord would not have a waiting list of potential tenants, but vacancies on his hands. If he were to act in such a way as to make too many tenants move, he would either be unable to replace those tenants, or he would have to reduce his rents below the general market in order to attract replacements. In this way, a landlord who did not satisfy his tenants would suffer financial loss. The landlord's self-interest would once again make him want to gain and keep tenants. Landlords would once again begin to compete with each other in terms of improved quality and service. They would have to, because they would need tenants once again, while tenants would no longer need any particular one of them. Let us turn now to another closely related major consequence of the combination of price controls and shortages, to the fact that they cause higher costs. In our discussion of the free market, we saw that producers have every incentive to reduce the costs of production in order both to expand their profits and to be able to meet the competition of others. Price controls and shortages remove those incentives in a variety of ways. First, in those cases in which goods come in a variety of models and price ranges, such as television sets, cars, lawnmowers, most goods, they create an incentive for producers to eliminate the more economical models while cutting corners in the production of the more expensive models. The reason this occurs is that, on the one hand, the buyers are willing and able to pay higher prices, and, on the other hand, corner cutting can generally be carried out with less disastrous results on the upper end of a product line than on the lower end. The process is actually a disguised way of raising prices, but it is a very uneconomic way of raising prices. Because in the process, many buyers end up having to pay more for more expensive models that they don't really need or want than they would have had to pay on a free market for the models they really do want. For example, someone seeking a 16-inch black and white television set may end up having to buy a 19-inch color set because that's all that's available. At the same time, the buyers who do want the better models find that they are not as good anymore. This process is the corollary of the decline in quality and service that we discussed earlier. And as soon as a shortage becomes severe enough, quality and service are cut to the point that buyers are offered models that would never appear on a free market in any price range. What happens is that sellers are led to cut corners in order to make relatively small savings to themselves, and which have a great impact on the buyers. For example, situations can exist in which it is advantageous to a seller to save a few cents in manufacturing costs that later impose many dollars in repair costs on the buyer. the harm inflicted on the buyers does not cause the sellers any economic loss, because at the controlled price, there is still a surplus of buyers eager to buy even a badly inferior product. Now, in the same way that price controls and shortages make it impossible for a consumer to select his model on the basis of cost, because the model he wants may be unavailable or discontinued, they also make it impossible for a businessman to select his methods of production on the basis of cost. For one or more of the factors of production he requires may simply be unobtainable because a price control has created a shortage of it. Under price controls, businessmen must select those methods of production for which the means happen to be available, and not necessarily those which have the lowest costs. The inability to find the right factors of production, of course, also frequently results in a decline in the quality of products as well, and should be viewed as a further cause of declining quality. Now, the very deterioration of quality and service itself is a further cause of higher costs, both to businessmen and consumers, as I have already indicated. If, for example, a machine is produced or serviced in an inferior way, then even if its price remains the same, it will cause higher costs of maintenance and repair and may have to be replaced sooner. The same obviously applies to many consumers' goods. If a television set lasts only half as long and has to be repaired twice as often, it is a lot more expensive to own, even though its price remains the same. Next, shortages of supplies and the mere threat of shortages themselves directly raise the costs of production. The effect of a shortage of a factor of production is to delay production. This causes the capital invested in all the other complementary factors of production that depend on it to have to be invested for a longer period of time than would otherwise be necessary. For example, a shortage of building nails causes capital to be invested in half-finished houses and in piles of lumber for an unnecessary period of time. Since interest must be paid on capital for the full time it is invested, the effect of all such delays is to raise the interest cost of production. Similarly, the mere anticipation of shortages of supplies leads businessmen to hoard supplies of all types. This requires that production be carried on with a larger capital investment in the additional stocks of supplies and in facilities for storing them. And this, of course, in turn means extra interest costs and extra costs on account of the storage facilities. Finally, there is the loss of the valuable time of executives in searching for sources of supply and in performing all the paperwork required to comply with the government's price controls and any associated regulations, such as rationing. It should be noted that shortages and the threat of shortages also directly raise costs to consumers. Consumers, too, suffer effects analogous to wasted investment and the need for more investment. For example, consumers who could not obtain gasoline could not use their cars or enjoy their country homes until such time as they could obtain gasoline. To that extent, the money they had spent for these complementary consumers' goods represented a kind of wasted investment. In addition, of course, consumers too are led to hoard supplies, and thus they too tie up larger sums of money in stocks of goods and quite possibly incur additional costs on account of acquiring extra storage facilities. For example, larger size gasoline tanks or extra home freezers if there should be the threat of a food shortage. And finally, one must mention the wasted man hours spent in waiting lines during every shortage, which, while not a money cost, are nonetheless a real hardship and burden and can well be at the expense of actual working time. Now, to some extent, the rise in business production costs that price controls and shortages bring about may come out of profits, but it certainly does not always do so. As, for example, when it is a case of concentrating on more expensive models that have correspondingly higher controlled prices. Moreover, it is possible for most or even all of the rise in costs not to come out of profits, at least not out of nominal profits, because the government may very well follow a policy of allowing prices to rise insofar as the producers can prove a rise in costs. This was the case to a large extent in World War II. During World War II, most defense contracts were written on a cost-plus basis. That is, the government paid defense contractors their costs plus a percentage of their costs as profit. And the same principle seems often to have been applied in setting the prices, in setting the price controls on civilian goods. This procedure, it should be realized, is tantamount to the positive encouragement of extra costs, because it makes the incurrence of extra costs the way to raise profits. It thereby totally perverts the profit motive from being the driving force of greater efficiency to being a driving force of greater inefficiency. I hasten to point out, however, that it would be a mistake to infer that price controls would be less destructive if they did not allow the pass-through of higher costs. That would serve to make supplies unobtainable that are available at the higher costs. The solution is not any change in the way price controls are applied, but the total and permanent abolition of the whole system. Now, as a final point, I must note that the willingness of the government to allow higher controlled prices on the basis of higher costs of production introduces a significant complication into the administration of price controls. This is a complication, incidentally, that applies to the present price controls on oil, as we will see. The complication arises because different parts of the supply of the same good will have different costs of production. As a result, the government must set a number of controlled prices on the identical good, depending on the particular cost of production incurred to produce the particular batch of goods in question. This procedure is generally accompanied by further procedures, all of which help to make price controls an administrative nightmare. What the government does is that it allows producers to sell to distributors or to further processors at varying prices corresponding to their varying costs. The distributors, however, are required to sell to the ultimate consumers at a uniform price based on an average of the varying costs to them as a group. By itself, this procedure would threaten some distributors with financial ruin while offering other distributors the prospect of correspondingly higher profits. Because all distributors must sell at the same price, while their costs may be significantly above or below the average on the basis of which that price is set. In order to deal with this problem, the government must assign to each distributor his, quote, fair share of low-cost goods and high-cost goods, or force the distributors to agree to some scheme of mutual compensation. Exactly this sort of situation exists today in the oil industry. Those firms that are supplied mainly with so-called old oil at $5.25 a barrel are forced to compensate the firms that must rely mainly on new oil that is controlled at a much higher price, or on imported oil that is not subject to controls at all and sells for about $13 a barrel. This is because both sets of firms must sell at essentially the same prices to consumers, and the consumer prices are based on an average of the prices of old, new, and imported oil. Under this arrangement, some oil companies are forced to turn over hundreds of millions of dollars, called entitlements, to other oil companies. This sort of arrangement is not only administratively chaotic, but often represents a partial expropriation of some firms for the benefit of their competitors. In principle, at least, it is also subject to various forms of corruption. But we need not enter into that aspect because I would consider it to be dignifying price controls if I were to spend time distinguishing corrupt controls from honest controls. Controls are simply destructive and vicious under every circumstance, and often more so the less subject they are to corruption. To be continued. Thank you. I have a variety of questions from this evening and still a carryover from previous weeks. Let me start with one question from last week, then perhaps we can get an oral question. When you bring your car to be serviced, it has been estimated that anywhere from 30 to 50% of the time, the problem will not be corrected because of either a lack of training on the part of the repairman or dishonesty. How is this possible in a field which is so free of any government regulation? Why doesn't the best service station win out? All right, now I know that it is certainly a very general impression that service stations have a very bad record. We can't say with real accuracy to what extent that is true, but let's assume it. Now, I would challenge the premise in this question that the field is free of government regulation. Let us look first at the auto industry itself, where the cars are produced. The manufacture of automobiles suffers from many problems. For example, it's known that cars produced on Mondays are not as good as cars produced during other days because the workers have not yet sobered up from the weekend. Or too many of them have not reported for work. Now, if we consider why does that condition exist? Well, it's because under compulsory labor unionism, these workers are almost unfireable. It is impossible for the management to create incentives to make these workers do a good job and have real quality control. Now, you might ask, how does this apply to the servicing of automobiles? Well, it may be the case, although I'm not sure, that these little small service stations that you see, like the local Shell station or whichever, maybe they don't have significant union problems. Maybe they are non-union. But now, let us consider the question, what would be the appropriate type of business to efficiently service new cars, or cars in general? Just think of the fact that there are many, many different models, and each year there's a new variety, and they have changes in the engines, the transmissions, and what have you. Now, to have an efficient service station operation, an efficient repair operation, you would have to have highly skilled mechanics who would each year undergo new training, who would have to become familiar with the new models and all the changes. Now, in order to make that pay, you cannot realistically expect the corner service station to do that kind of job. You would have to have specialists, someone, let's say, who is really familiar with every last nut and bolt about a Dodge Polara, and who had trained in that, and who would retrain more the next year. The only way that that could pay would be if you had very large-scale service facilities. Now, a large-scale service facility that was specializing in certain types of cars would make it economical to have specialized mechanics who knew everything there was to know about them. Well, what would be required for the successful functioning of this type of service station? That it would have to be free of unionization. Now, the different manufacturers do have their own service facilities. They are better because of the greater specialization than most of the service stations, but they are union dominated and they cannot be nearly as good as they would be. So I would say the answer to the problems of repair is that they have to be done on a larger scale, and to be done efficiently, they would have to be free of the interference of the labor unions, which I consider crippling to efficiency. So the real problem is government intervention again. Now, do we have any questions from the floor? This lady?
What I was going to say, you understand the topic that Rolex stands for production. Do you
You say that the oil companies understand, I wasn't quite sure what you say they understand. They understand that they have to you say the oil companies understand the profit principle. Therefore, why don't they re-educate the government or the general public? Well, what I would say is the oil companies understand what to do to make profits. That is not the same thing as understanding the profit principle. See, they can decide, they're expert at figuring out what is the best method of looking for oil or the best method of drilling a well. And they know that to make profits, they have to constantly keep at this and do it as best they can. But they do not have an economist's understanding of the uniformity of profit principle. They've probably never heard of the uniformity of profit principle. So I would assume that virtually no one in the oil industry has any serious knowledge of economic theory. Worse than that, I would think that very, very few people in the oil industry have any moral courage, even to put together some simple facts. Like if you think about the facts I enumerated to you of how the government has been responsible for holding down the supply of oil and restricting the demand, I'm sure all of you recognize these facts once I name them to you. Well, they're known to the oil companies. Why don't they speak out on this? Well, I think it's because they are pragmatists. They think that ideas do not count. They don't care what ideas are going around them in the culture. They think they'll take out their usual congressman friends, they'll make the right campaign contributions as they have been, and that will square everything. So I would think that they probably have a terrible contempt for ideas. And that is why they're helpless. Yes, sir?
What effect do the individual state oil corporations have on the price of oil
supply? You ask, what effect do individual state oil proration laws? Do you mean by oil proration laws laws that determine the extent to which wells can be operated?
Yeah.
You're referring to the fact that, for example, in the state of Texas, there is an agency called the State Railway Commission, I believe, which prescribes the extent to which the wells can be operated at any given time. Well, that would artificially hold down the supply of oil. So there would be a government interference restricting the output of oil. Yeah? Is Texas the only state that has such a law? I don't know. Would you state again in what way price controls reduce supply by making a local market uncompetitive? All right, one way is that if there is, as I explained in Lecture 4, if there is a local shortage, a local scarcity, and the local price is prevented from rising in response to the local scarcity, that will prevent the local area from importing additional supplies. For example, the price control on oil and gasoline in the northeastern United States, in preventing prices from rising in this area, prevented this area from bringing about the importation of additional supplies from the rest of the country and from foreign nations. Had our price been higher, it would have covered transportation costs, the oil would have been shipped. Now tonight, I handled the same principle from a somewhat different aspect. Namely, if you have an area which normally exports, well, if something occurs which would increase the export demand, and there is a price control in the local market, that means the local market is prevented from bidding up the price and reducing the exports. To go over that example again, back in 72 and 73, or starting in August 71, in August 71, the dollar was devalued. In 73, it was devalued again. That meant it cost fewer marks, francs, etc., to buy dollars. and therefore fewer marks, francs, etc., to buy wheat and soybeans at the frozen prices of wheat and soybeans. The export demand of those goods jumped radically. But their prices here at home domestically could not rise. The prices, in other words, were the same domestically and cheaper to foreigners. So we couldn't stop foreigners from going on buying. They just kept buying because the prices became cheaper, and they could have gone on buying without limit, and we had no way to protect our supplies by bidding up the price. So that reduced supplies. Now the question, would you favor decontrol of utility prices without a simultaneous abolition of their monopoly status? Meaning their exclusive franchises. That's what gives them a monopoly. Well, I would say if you consider what the alternatives are, if the controls remain in force, and if that is to be the alternative, if the controls remain in force, the utility industry will be destroyed. And that means our economy will be destroyed. If the controls were repealed, but the exclusive franchise is not repealed, well, maybe utility rates would go up 10%, maybe 20% above what they would be in a free market. There'd be some limited increase, and that would be it. The utility industry would not be destroyed. So if one had to choose between price controls and the destruction of the utility industry, or no price controls and there being monopolies, it would be better that they be monopolies. But they don't have to be monopolies. You could repeal the exclusive franchise. Another question. Don't you think that the government will nationalize the utilities rather than allow them to decline and eventually be destroyed? Well, the government might nationalize the utilities, but of course that is not incompatible with their decline and destruction. But this will be a question, if you like, you can bring it up again after, I think, lecture, after next week's lecture. We'll go into that aspect. Mr. Schwartz? If there were simply controls on the rate of return, well, if you control the rate of return in any industry below the general rate, you destroy that industry. Pardon me? All right, you're asking what would be the effect of a control on the rate of profit in all industries nationwide. All right, let me ask you to bring that question up again if you want to, at the end of either next week or lecture 8. I think we'd be better equipped to handle it then. The results, I think, would be essentially similar to what we'll see are the results of universal price controls. Yes, sir? All right, you're saying... All right, I don't quite get the first part of your question. Are you assuming that I am assuming that the supply of housing has to be increased immediately?
Well, but otherwise we have chaos in the city of New York. I don't see what purpose it would serve to have decontrolled in rents.
If we had decontrolled in rents, I cannot give you a full answer now because this is an issue that I go into in greater detail next week. If we had decontrolled in rents, one consequence would be that the supply of housing would begin to increase. Now, granted, it may take 2 years to put up new buildings, but then in 2 years, the supply would be larger. Now, what about before 2 years? Well, within months, we would have a larger supply, Because, first of all, the abandonment of existing buildings would stop. Many buildings which have recently been abandoned would be put back into operation. Immediately, the quality and service associated with housing would increase. Now, I don't want to say more than that now, because next week I will argue in favor of the immediate repeal of rent control and show why, from the very first day of repeal, more people would find their existing but unrecognized hardship alleviated than would suffer any newly created hardship. I will show next week that there is a large unrecognized class of rent control victims who, from the very first day of repeal, forgetting about any increase in supply, from the very first day of repeal, their situation would be improved. Yes? Approximately what percentage of housing in New York City is rent controlled? Well, as of now, all the housing that was constructed prior to January 1974 is under one form of rent control or another. But I'll go into more specifics next week when I discuss that subject in more detail. Any other questions from the floor? All right, I have a question. Would not the free market still operate unless universal controls are imposed? And if so, would aggregate supply actually be reduced because of local controls only? All right, I would say the free market could not operate with any effectiveness if such vital industries as the electric utilities and the oil industry are destroyed. And I will assert now and prove next week or the following week, I forget just which when I get into it, I think the following week in lecture 8. Next week we have a full discussion of partial controls. I'll show how next week partial controls reduce total supply. You ask, would not uncontrolled markets grow larger at the expense of controlled markets? Again, something to go into next week. It seems to me that the free market will always operate unless completely stifled. Well, that is not so unless one means some people somewhere will attempt to make some transactions to their own interest. That is not a free market. That goes on even in Russia. In Russia, there are still people who clandestinely approach a tourist and ask to buy his camera or something. But that is not enough for a free market. Yes, sir? Well, as I said, I would go into them in lecture 9. I have a question. You said that production enhances man's environment. Does this imply that consumption degrades man's environment? No, not at all. The consumption is the end result of the production. The production improves the environment by ultimately making it possible for man to consume in a better way. Anything, any other live questions from the floor? All right, I have a question from last week. I think I'm reading it correctly. It's difficult to read the handwriting. The solutions to many energy problems lie in using cheaper but more polluting fuels. Assuming that such air pollution is demonstrably dangerous to health, what would be your stand for the free market versus health preservation via legal restrictions against such polluting fuels in this context? The question is assuming there's a conflict between health and the free market based on the idea of the fuels causing pollution. Let me say that whenever you can find a case in which one individual is doing something which damages the person or property of another, that action is a violation of the free market. It is not part of the free market for anyone to commit any act of physical force or damage against the person or property of another. Now that means, if I were to have a giant incinerator on my property that was dumping soot on your adjacent property, I would be violating your property rights, and the free market would require that I be stopped. Now, such protections have existed always, and the ecology movement was not necessary to bring them into existence. What the ecology movement has in mind is not cases in which individuals are doing specific, clear-cut, provable harm to other individuals. It has in mind cases in which the action of the individual has no demonstrable effect on any other individual. For example, if I am driving my car and it is emitting a certain trace of carbon monoxide or whatever, I am not doing any harm to anyone. Therefore, I would say one does not have an action against me. Now you might say, but there are tens of thousands of people doing the same thing as you, and that all adds up to something. I would say, yes, it does add up to something. It adds up to a less pleasant living condition. Now, ever since cities have come into existence, it has been a known fact that life in cities, in some respects, is a little less healthful than life in the countryside. This is simply an outgrowth of people living together in large numbers. I would say that the ill health associated with living in cities is much less today than in the past, largely because of the automobile and because of other advances. If you think back, for example, to the turn of the century, the population of Manhattan Island was larger than it is today, and it was all crowded into the area below 59th Street. Now, that environment was much less healthful than today. People spent much more time indoors in dank surroundings with poor ventilation. Today, people are much more spread out. Today, because of the automobile, you can live in the suburbs, drive 30 or 40 miles to work. You have air conditioning in the summertime. You have central heating in the wintertime. I would say the general quality of people's air is infinitely better as a result of the automobile and general industrial progress. But now, still the fact remains, even with these improvements, living in a place like New York City may not be quite as healthful as living in, say, Crawfordsville, Indiana, because the cars do emit a little extra pollution and whatever. Well, that is not sufficient justification for trying to level the cities down to the countryside. We cannot reproduce the conditions of the country in the city without destroying the cities in the process. Now, those people who may observe that you might, on the average, have an extra couple of years of life expectancy if you live in Crawfordsville or whatever, well, fine. If you attach the advantages of if you attach more to the advantages of Crawfordsville than New York, then that is where you should move, but not try to bring Crawfordsville to New York. Now, finally, suppose you observe there are things that could be done. See, let me point out that one very definite danger that will destroy our entire economy is if we were to give the government the authority to regulate what kind of industry could locate where. You see, you cannot give to the government the power to say, well, we consider New York to have sufficient air pollution now. We refuse to allow any more industry to locate in New York. Or we refuse to allow more cars to enter New York. That's giving the government power to decide where industry is located. It's total economic power. But what you could do, suppose you observe that there's a certain category of industrial use that if it were stopped, would mean some improvement in local conditions. But you can't expect the company to do it because that would raise their costs. If they had to do it, they'd be better off locating somewhere else. And you'd like that industry to remain. Well, then let all those who are worried about the local quality of the air, let them get together, put up some money, and let them go to these concerns, which are not doing any provable damage to anyone, and let them volunteer with the money that they raise voluntarily to correct the problem. You do not need the government taking over the economy of the country to make the air a little bit cleaner. Any further questions from the floor? Let me point out one general principle that the ecologists have been getting away with, and it seems they haven't been challenged on. And that is, they assume that any time they can demonstrate that one person's actions have an impact or some kind of effect on other people, they are entitled to act. Now, it is not true that merely having an effect on the conditions of others is grounds for the government taking action against you. You must have a very specific kind of effect, namely, you must be resorting to physical force. Merely having some kind of adverse impact, if that's the criterion of the government acting, that means that all progress must be destroyed. Because consider the adverse impact that Henry Ford had on the horse breeders and buggy makers. Now, should he have been made to subsidize their losses? Is it the case, is it rational to ask that everyone who does something which has certain detrimental effects on other people, if we require that he be made to pay the cost of all of those effects, then we are asking that the auto industry pay the costs of putting its competitors out of business. We're asking each innovator to subsidize the inefficiency of his backward competitors. The only thing we have a right to ask is that an individual pay for any actual provable damages that he does physically. Like if I drive my car into the side of your house, I should have to pay for that. But if I'm selling a car while you're selling a buggy and you have to leave your house, I should not have to pay for that. Let us take just one last question. We'll have to have a short period tonight. Next week we can have a longer question period. Are there any further questions from the floor? Okay, well then let's call it an evening. Thank you.